6. Our first question, just to get that out of the way real quick, what can we read of these events outside of Isaiah, a parallel passage? Remember, Harry kind of mentioned that Wednesday. Right. You got 2 Kings chapters 18, 19, and 20. And I mentioned a few specific verses there in the questions as well. But also 2 Chronicles 32. 2 Kings is going to be in most places almost word for word. There are obviously some differences. And as we'll see in a second, there are some things that Isaiah left out that preceded the events of verse 1 or of when the Rabshakeh, however you pronounce that, that's how I'm going to pronounce it, when he came and started, you know, making his threats. We'll look at that in a second. And then 2 Chronicles 32 is different. That section covers more of Hezekiah's life in regard to his reforms and the keeping of the Passover and his faithfulness to God that is in stark contrast to Ahaz. And so that would be beneficial to read at some time if you have opportunity. I did want to point out a few things before we get to the text of Isaiah 36. We'll cover chapters 36 and 37. But in verse 1, it says, "It came to pass in the 14th year of King Hezekiah that Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and took them." Now, what that did is it moved Hezekiah to act in a couple of different ways that is not recorded here in Isaiah 36 by Isaiah here, but it is in 2 Chronicles and 2 Kings, chapter 32 of 2 Chronicles and chapter 18 of 2 Kings. And it, I think that it, at least for me, it helped me understand some of the lessons learned in these two chapters, especially by Hezekiah. We've been studying throughout this Assyrian period, remembering the historical outline covering the first 39 chapters and segueing in by these historical chapters into the Babylonian period, talking about future events, that the Lord is trying to get the people to trust in Him, and they're the kings and leaders and the prophets, they're leading the people astray to trust in the arm of flesh, other countries, other nations, other people, and not trusting in Jehovah. Hezekiah is a good king, a righteous king. He's a king of prayer, as we'll see in chapter 36 and 37, or 37 also in chapter 39 with his sickness. So no doubt and he's righteous, but he's also a man, and I think that's worthy of being pointed out from time to time, that you've got righteous individuals in the Bible, but they're men, and they do have their faults, and they do learn the hard way sometimes. I think we see a little bit about that with Hezekiah. He wasn't like Ahaz, who had zero faith and didn't even want to hear the Lord's word when he gave him the sign of Emmanuel in chapter 7, but Hezekiah had some learning to do as well. So in 2 Chronicles 32 in the first 8 verses, and we'll not read it, there, after hearing about and understanding the advances of the Assyrians, and they're taking all these fortified cities of Judah, Sennacherib coming down upon Jerusalem, Hezekiah decided to consult, and we'll make this contrast later, he consulted with the commanders, he consulted with the people in his cabinet, so to speak, about what to do, and they did various things against the threat of Assyria. They stopped the water from the springs outside the city, and this is why Hezekiah said, "Why should the kings of Assyria come and find much water?" They built up the walls of Jerusalem. There were breaches that they repaired. They tore apart houses that were near the wall, and they fortified that wall. They fortified the outside wall. They built up the Millo, or the Milo, which is a fortress that is composed of earth being built up. Read a little bit about that. Retaining walls and filling that in so that there's, you know, elevation to build on, and that gives some more fortification against enemies. They built that up. They repaired some of that. They made weapons and they made shields. And I think that in Isaiah 22, there's a section there when he speaks about the burden against the Valley of Vision, which is Jerusalem, where it seems to describe some of those actions taken against the threat of Assyria. I taught this section in the last section of the burden against the nations, and we had to speed right through this. So we didn't get to talk about it a lot. But there in Isaiah 22, it says that he removed the protection from Judah. Isaiah 22, verse 8. You look to that day to the armor of the house of the forest. That's an armory that's built. You also saw the damage to the city of David. It was great. So you gathered together the waters of the lower pool. They built made a reservoir in between the inner and outer wall. You numbered the houses of Jerusalem and the houses you broke down to fortify the wall. You made a reservoir between the two walls for the water of the old pool. But notice, you did not look to its maker. When Hezekiah did that in 2 Chronicles 32, he encouraged the people to be strong and courageous. Don't worry about the armed flesh and don't worry about Assyria, because we have God on our side. And I believe he was a man of faith, and he certainly meant that. But the people seemed to not be all in like him in that regard. But even his actions, I think, indicate, though maybe in sincerity, not even thinking about it, that his trust was not yet fully in the Lord like it would be when he gets this threat, when the Rabshakeh comes. And so just think a little bit about that. In 2 Kings 18 and verse 7, we read he's doing something different than Ahaz. Remember, Ahaz went to the king of Assyria when he was threatened by Syria and Israel. And Assyria is the biggest threat, but he thought, if I can get on his side, then I'll be okay. And so he starts paying tribute to Assyria. Well, in 2 Kings 18:7, it says the Lord was with him, that is Hezekiah, and he prospered wherever he went. And he rebelled against the kingdom of Syria and did not serve him. Now, that may have included several things that he did that indicated that rebellion, but certainly one of them was he stopped paying tribute. But in 2 Kings 18 and verse 13, and we have this as a question through 16, what did Hezekiah do when he sees Sennacherib take the fortified cities of Judah? Anybody get that? That's our third question. Yeah, absolutely. So he had rebelled, stopped paying tribute, and then he actually apologized. He said, I have done wrong. And he tried to pay him off. He tried to restore the tribute. And did that work? No, because that's where we are in chapter 36. So you see what I'm saying? This is a righteous man. He's a man of prayer. He's a good king. But it took him a little bit to learn fully, I need to be trusting in God instead. Sennacherib had a clay prism where he detailed his conquests and victories and really just was full of himself, bragged about himself. That's in a museum somewhere in Europe. I can't remember which museum. But he details some of his dealings with Hezekiah and with Jerusalem. And one of the things that he says is Hezekiah himself, who the terror-inspiring splendor of my lordship have overwhelmed, and who did send to me later to Nineveh, my lordly city, together with 30 talents of gold, 800 talents of silver, precious stones, in order to deliver the tribute and to do obeisance as a slave, he sent his personal messenger. Now, the agreement was 100 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold, but you see in 2 Kings, he strips the temple of gold and the doors of its gold, and it's even more than what was original. So he's trying to think of ways to turn Assyria away. And what we're going to see in chapter 36 and 37, especially 37, is that then he starts going to the house of the Lord and he starts consulting Isaiah, who is the mouthpiece of God, and you see him get the point, because it didn't work. He didn't turn them away. So one more thing. What we're going to read in verse 1 is also detailed to a certain degree on Sennacherib's prism. And he said, as to Hezekiah the Jew, he did not submit to my yoke. I laid siege to 46 of his strong cities, walled forts, and to the countless small villages in their vicinity, and conquered them. I drove out of them 200,150 people, young and old, male and female, horses, mules, donkeys, camels, big and small cattle beyond counting, and considered them booty. Hezekiah himself I made a prisoner in Jerusalem, his royal residence, like a bird in a cage. I surrounded him with earthwork in order to molest those who were leaving his city's gate. Thus I reduced his country, but I still increased his tribute. Here's something interesting that Sennacherib did not mention on that prism, did not detail in his writing, and that is conquering Jerusalem. And it's because it never happened. he might have fudged a little bit on some of these details. He's certainly puffing himself up. But it's pretty much parallel with the biblical account. And then there is no taking Jerusalem, because the Lord had said all along, as we've been studying, it's not going to happen. And it didn't happen. Comments, questions on this before we get further? Yes. I think that Hezekiah's faith, I think we saw that in 2 Chronicles 32, Bible classes, that you had the effects of Ahaz that already done their work. And so you've got a righteous king who's trying to reform the nation and bring people to trust and fear God, but the damage has been done, so there's going to be some struggle there. But like I said, I think that there's still... at least his actions, what they say to me is that he wasn't all the way there yet. Maybe I'm using a little liberty in interpreting that, but it seems that if he trusted in God, he wouldn't have sent tribute. He would have asked God, what do you want me to do? And in chapter 22, evidently, in bringing that reservoir and preparing for that siege, it says there, the prophet says, you didn't look to his anchor. And so there was something missing. There was a disconnect there. We pray to God and ask Him what He wants us to do, especially there with military thought. It doesn't mean that we don't have faith because we're taking action. It's a matter of doing what He tells us to do. So, Harry. It says that he consulted with the leaders and commanders. And so that's kind of the exact opposite of what Isaiah has been trying to get them to understand at this point.
Yeah, I think that's the point. You know, there's acting and doing something and acting in a manner of wisdom. We always talk about that. There's something we should do and need to do. Well, what first needs to happen is consulting with God and making sure that we're praying to Him, making sure that us, with the revealed message that we have, that we go into His message, and that we're acting accordingly to what is there.
Right.
And so that first step is understanding there's a control where the wisdom comes from to be able to act properly in the way it's ready to.
Yeah. That's the asking in faith of James 1, I think, is I'm not asking God, having already decided what I'm going to do, and basically asking God's blessings. I'm asking God with a pure heart of inquiry. What do you really want me to do? Now, for us, we're going to study the Scriptures when we're praying to do that. And we're going to leave out those reservations and those temptations we're going to overcome. But with them, it would have been, you know, what I think, what makes that, why didn't you go to Isaiah immediately? You know he's the prophet of God, and he would have told you. And it happened after Rabshakeh and the other two come down on Jerusalem. You have anything else? Something that helps me, I got to remind myself, Isaiah, he prophesied over what's the amount of years was his prophecy going on. But these prophecies are compiled, so they weren't necessarily all written at the same time. And so he's telling them throughout this, things are going to happen, this is what you need to do, and if you don't do that, this is what's going to happen furthermore. And so it's not like this is just all of a sudden, oh, what do I do? I'm completely ignorant about it. There was obviously a need to grow in faith. Aaron? There's a lot of practical lessons here, that's for sure. All right, so unless we start, we're not going to get to chapter 37. So, all right, chapter 36 and verse 1, you've got the Sennacherib taking these fortified cities. He said there's 46, and so he took them. And then in verse 2, it says the Rabshakeh is sent with a great army to King Hezekiah from Sennacherib. Again, don't be too harsh on my pronunciation of that. In 2 Kings, you have two others that are mentioned there, and you see that reflected in Isaiah 36 when he says servants in chapter 37, verses 6 and 24. There's the Tartan that we actually saw in chapter 20 as he is mentioned as going and making war on Libya. And then you have the Rabsaris, which all of these are titles, they're not names. So at least in my Bible, there was some thoughts about what those might be. Tartan, commander-in-chief, Rabsaris, chief officer, and Rabshakeh that we see in Isaiah 36, the chief of staff or governor. At the very least, he is the chief spokesman here in these situations. So he comes, and he's sent by Sennacherib to basically threaten them and make fun of God and try to intimidate them into submission. And what Hezekiah does is he sends three as well, Eliakim, Shebna, and Joah, the son of Asaph. And so they come out, and Rabshakeh starts mocking Hezekiah, and he mocks God. He challenges them, and we see that recorded there in the first 20 verses as he threatens them. He does a number of things. Notice first in verse 4, he tells those servants of Hezekiah, thus says the great king of Assyria, or say now to Hezekiah, thus says the great king of Assyria. So he doesn't even mention Hezekiah as king. He mentions Assyria as the great king of Assyria. And so that just is the tip of the iceberg. And he's starting to kind of belittle the people and belittle Hezekiah. What does he do first in verses 4 through 6? What does he mention? Who are you trusting in? Who's your confidence in? Are you trusting in Egypt? And he's doing this, and it's ironic because he knows Egypt isn't going to be able to help. God knew and was trying to tell him, don't trust in them. It may be that he knew of some of the political moves that Jerusalem had made that we saw back in chapter 30, how they sent those people with treasures down to Egypt through the Negev, the south, and knew about that, and so was kind of mocking that and trying to belittle that, or maybe he just some things about the political environment, but at any rate, he's saying, you have plans for power and war, but they're just words. And that's something that God had said in his judgments against Judah and Jerusalem before, is that you're taking counsel, but not of me, and you're trying to make all these plans, and I'm going to bring your wisdom to foolishness. It's just mere words if you're not trusting in God. Now, this is the Rabshakeh, and he's saying that from arrogance, that none of your plans are going to work. He says, you're trusting in Egypt, and he describes it as the staff of this broken reed on which if a man leans, it will go into his hand and pierce it. And so you're leaning on Egypt, and it's not only going to be ineffective, it's going to backfire on you. It's going to actually hurt you. Not just not help you, but it will actually hurt you. And he's certainly right about that, though he's not speaking from God's point of view, speaking from Assyria's point of view. But then he goes to something else in verse 7. Trust in Egypt, that's ridiculous. Now what does he look at in verse 7? God, right? Don't say, we trust in the Lord our God. And then he says, whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah has taken away and said to Judah and Jerusalem, you shall worship before this altar. So don't trust in God. And he has a very fundamental misunderstanding of who this God is. And so in 2 Chronicles, you see detailed explanation of Hezekiah bringing down the high places, restoring true worship. What were the high places for? Idolatry. No wonder he tore them down. Now, Rabshakeh and Sennacherib, they're looking at that thinking, how foolish, you're rebelling against your own God, you're taking down his altars, and you've got nothing to turn to. Don't trust in him. Hezekiah's already made sure that you don't have that to lean on. So don't lean on Egypt, don't lean on the Lord. And instead, give a pledge to the king of Assyria, and I'll give you 2,000 horses. And then he mocks, if you're able to have enough riders to put on them. So he's just full of this arrogance, and he's pretty good with his words. He's trying to intimidate them, and we'll see that it works to a degree. And then he says, how then will you repel one captain of the least of my master's servants to put your trust in Egypt for chariots and horsemen? So the least of Assyria, you wouldn't be able to stand up against. He's trying to intimidate them. Then he does something even furthermore and more base than what he has thus far. In verse 10, he says, have I now come up without the Lord against this land to destroy it? The Lord said to me, go up against this land to destroy it. True or false? False? Okay, what did we read before, though, about Assyria? Lord is using Assyria. That's not his mindset, though. Remember in chapter 10, but he does not think of it in that way. He does not think so. The Lord is using him as a tool, but he does not think so. He does not mean so, and we'll see that in chapter 37. You were just arrogant and mean and hateful and blasphemous and brutal, and the Lord saw your coming in and going out. But Assyria seems to think that they're in great control. So then those messengers of Hezekiah say, speak in Aramaic. We understand that. Don't speak in Hebrew. We don't want every one of these people on the wall to hear and be intimidated. What does he then do? Speaks in Hebrew. In 2 Chronicles 32:18, it says that they called out with a loud voice in to the people of Jerusalem who were on the wall to frighten them and trouble them that they might take the city. So, all right. It's almost like they poked the bear. Just speak in Hebrew or in Aramaic and don't let all these people hear. And he says, I'll show you. And he screams out in Hebrew. And he says this, I've been sent to say this to these people as well who will eat and drink their own waste with you. When a city was besieged, the people were shut up in the city until their resources depleted to the extent that it was bad enough, they would be so desperate they would eat and drink their own waste. And that's what he's saying. This is what's going to happen to all of you. Don't let your leaders fool you. This is going to happen. It's going to be terrible. So just submit to us. So he says, hear the words of the king of Assyria. Don't let Hezekiah deceive you. He will not be able to deliver you. So he starts there and he breaks down their trust and confidence in the king. He's not going to do it. Don't let him make you trust in the Lord, saying the Lord will deliver us into the city, be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. Don't listen to Hezekiah. He can't save you. The Lord can't save you. And then in verse 16, he says, make peace with me by present. Come out to me. And then he does something that Satan does to us all the time. He makes that surrender to the enemy sound better than standing up for the Lord. There's going to be difficulty here. It takes courage and it takes sacrifice to stand up for the cause. But the enemy makes it seem better to surrender. He says, every one of you will eat from his own vine and his own fig, drink from his own waters. until we take you to that land. So we're still going to take you, but we're going to let you just take it easy. And you're going to eat your own food, not your waste. You're going to be able to go about freely in your land. We'll leave you alone right now. Then we'll take you away. And then he says, when we take you away to a different land, it's going to be like your own. It's going to be great. It's going to be filled with new wine, land of bread and vineyards. Was that true about the Assyrian captives that were taken during their conquest? How did Assyria treat their captives? Terrible. Brutal. There was no truth in this whatsoever, but he's just trying to get them to submit. Don't let Hezekiah say the Lord will deliver us, because what gods under these nations and cities have been able to deliver them? And so he's equating Jehovah with all these idols, and he lists some of them. So he is just relentless in trying to intimidate them and force them into submission, to the extent of being very dishonest about what their intentions are. And that's the way the enemy always is, always dishonest. False doctrine may sound good, it is always corrupt. The sin that we're enticed to commit, it's always corrupt. It always bears fruit of putrid nature, of complete and total depravity and wickedness and negativity. There's nothing good about it, and we need to realize that every time we're tempted to submit to that. So the servants were not to answer him by Hezekiah's instructions. They tore their clothes. They are completely distraught and worried, and that's when they go to Hezekiah. So we get to chapter 37, and you have Hezekiah informed of what happened. It says he tore his clothes, covered himself with sackcloth, went into the house of the Lord, going into the house of the Lord most likely to pray and petition God. But what he does now is he sends these three, Eliakim and Shebna, that is, and then some of the elders of the priests, covered in sackcloth, to Isaiah. So now I'm going to inquire of the Lord. There we see it. Now I know. There's absolutely nothing I can do politically, militaristically. There's no chance that we have without God. I'm going to inquire of him. And so they take the message of Hezekiah to Isaiah. And Hezekiah says to Isaiah through them, "It's a day of trouble and rebuke and blasphemy, for the children have come to birth, and there is no strength to bring them forth." And so that's how miserable it is and how weak they are, like a woman going through childbirth, but she is so drained of strength that she can't finish the job. She can't birth that child. They're completely helpless and completely impotent, and they need the Lord. It may be that he'll hear the words of the Rabshakeh and the master of Assyria has reproached the living God. Therefore, lift up your prayer, he says to Isaiah. So what did Hezekiah hear when he heard of all the things Rabshakeh said? Did he take offense personally? Who did he take offense for? God. I think that's an important point to note. As a king, he could have easily been filled with so much pride. He hears those words and he just gets angry because, "I'm King Hezekiah. How dare you talk to me like that?" But he didn't. He was offended on God's behalf. It was God that was being belittled. It was God that was being ridiculed and mocked and scorned. You know, it's similar to David's thoughts. Is there not a cause? It's not about us. It's not about me. You've defied the armies of the God of Israel. He's the Lord of hosts. He's the Almighty One. How dare you come up against him in this manner? And so that's how Hezekiah saw all of this and thought about all of this. He's completely distraught because of how God's being treated and how God's being viewed. And so they came to Isaiah and said that. And what was Isaiah's response in verses 6 through 7? "Don't be afraid. What's God going to do? Send a spirit upon him. He'll hear what? A rumor and return to his land. And what? Fall by the sword." We see that come to fruition at the end of the chapter. But don't be afraid of this. They're talking big and they're not going to be able to do anything when it comes down to it. Now remember, the Spirit he sends upon him is not necessarily taking away his free will and making him go crazy or anything of that sort, but he's been using that concept throughout, even with the children of Israel, by giving them to their own wisdom, giving them to their own thoughts. And so he's going to hear a rumor, perhaps of war or some other thing, and he's going to return to his land where he gets killed by his two sons later on. Comments, questions on that section? Yes. Yeah. You know, the last section that Harry covered, you know, mentioned you're plundered. You haven't been plundered. There's no, they don't, you know, he said of the Medes and the Persians earlier in prophecy that basically silver and gold will mean nothing to them. They don't care. You can't buy them off. They don't care. They just have a thirst for blood and conquest, and it would be terrifying. Absolutely. There's no stopping this person and his will. Only God can turn him back and gain victory over that. Yeah. Absolutely. You think about it in a context like this military context, in war context, that's part of the reason why you get in the Word often and remember what God has done in the past. Hezekiah should have remembered how God had delivered the people that belonged to him time and time again throughout the past. Most times, well, every time, but a lot of times it made very clear, miraculously, that this couldn't have ever been attributed to anything you did. It was always by the hand of the Lord. Countless times God made sure. Think of, Midian and the victory there, and the fact that that was, you know, brought down to a number of 300 to make sure they knew it was God who delivered them. So, great point. So God is always the one that has the power and victory. So, you have the Rabshakeh then returns to Libna. Now, Sennacherib was warring at Lachish, about 25 miles southwest of Jerusalem. He had moved on to Libna, 10 miles north of Lachish. So, warring there, and he goes there, and you have the Sennacherib is told something about the king of Ethiopia, Tirhaka, and he's coming out to make war. And so, now he doubles down. I already got to deal with Ethiopia. Let's make sure Jerusalem just says no thanks, and they give up, so we don't have to deal with both of them at the same time. So he sends messengers with evidently a letter, because Isaiah is going to spread that out. And the letter was very insulting, just like the Rabshakeh. It doubled down on the fact that they had taken all of these lands and their gods couldn't deliver them, which was true, but they had a misunderstanding of the God of the Israelites. It's not the same as these other gods. So Hezekiah receives the letter, and then he spreads it out before Jehovah and the house of the Lord. He's saying, look at this. We need you now. Complete humility. Complete dependence upon God. Finally, he gets it. and he prays to God, and he does a number of things. That's one of our questions, a thought question. And something that just came to my attention is that it's almost the exact parallel as far as the format to the prayer prayed in Acts 4 after the apostles were threatened and let go, and they went to their own and they prayed. They first praised God, said who God was to God, exalted His name. You're the one before the cherubim. You're over all the kingdoms of the earth. You made heaven and earth. So this is who you are. They're tearing you down. They're belittling you. We know who you are. We know the power that you wield. But then He tells them about the problems. Incline your ear. Hear about what Sennacherib said. Hear about how he had indeed taken these lands and the idols didn't deliver them. But you're not like these idols. We know that's not how you are. They destroyed them, but you are the one who has all power. And then he says, let all the kingdoms of earth know that you are the Lord, you alone. You have praise, you have casting your cares upon him, and then you have, please do this, please deliver for your name's sake. That's important. And that's what you see in Acts, the fourth chapter, that I thought was very interesting. It's kind of almost a parallel where they thought about God and how great He was and praised Him in prayer. And then they brought up how God had prophesied about how they would revolt against Him and try to thwart His will. And that only turned out to accomplish God's will. He's in control. And He sees the trouble that they're in right now, and they bring it to His attention. So God, please deliver us, that the gospel may be preached for your will, for your cause, that all can know you're in control and this is your will. And their prayer was answered. So maybe that's just a little interesting thought. I thought it was a powerful thought. So then after he prays, Isaiah says in verse 21, thus says the Lord God of Israel, because you have prayed to me against Sennacherib, king of Assyria, this is the word of the Lord which has spoken concerning him. And he first addresses Assyria by talking about Zion, that now Zion, this virgin daughter of Zion, she's going to laugh at you. You're laughing at her now. You think that you've got the upper hand. Things are going to be turned around. You're going to be scorned by her, called virgin, most likely because she's not been defiled like all these other nations and cities that Assyria has taken. And then he addresses specifically Sennacherib and Assyria. Who have you blasphemed and reproached? Against whose who have you raised your voice against the Holy One of Israel? You're blaspheming the one and only true God who has that kind of power, and you're boasting as if you did all this yourself by the multitude of my chariots. I have come up to the height of the mountains, to the limits of Lebanon. I will cut down all the tall cedars and the choice cypress trees. I will enter furthest height and into the fruitful forest. I'm doing all of this. This is by my power. I have dug and drunk water. Where there was no water, I made sure we found water. We weren't going to thirst. And I dried up with the soles of my feet all the brooks of defense. So where there was water, I cut it off from my enemies. I'm doing all this. I'm in control. I'm good and mighty. And then God says, didn't you hear long ago that I made it? I brought this forth. That you should be for crushing and fortified cities into heaps of ruins. He said, "This I'm letting you do this. This is by my will. The only reason you are conquering to this degree is because I'm punishing all these people and using you as a tool to do so. And that's why they're all powerless before you. They had little power, dismayed and confounded, like grass of the field, green herb, grass on the housetops, grain blighted before it is grown. They're weak and impotent before you because that's how I've made it. How dare you act as though you've got all this power? He knows you're coming out and going in. He knows that you're not doing this out of any pure motives or intentions, but you're brutal. You're godless. You are blasphemous. You have a rage against me. Come up against my ears, so I'm going to turn you away. He promises to Jerusalem that in 3 years, essentially, you're going to be back to normal. You're not going to sow and reap now. You're going to be able to eat, though, by my providence. You'll have that supplied to you just by what's fallen by the wayside, and the remnant will grow. They will be fruitful again. He's not going to lay siege against you. That's not going to happen. And then the picture of that miraculous delivery in the last few verses and him returning to his own land. And about 20 years later, he's slayed by his sons. So that's chapter 36 and 37. Before we dismissed, I will say that chronologically there are some differences and what the actual order might have been, that's given cause for skeptics to say this is not God's word. But as we've already seen in many places in the Bible, that even Isaiah, his point is not chronology. His point is not chronological accuracy, but he's got a point to make. So chapters 37 or 38 and 39 seem to be about something that had happened before 36 and 37. And I'll let Harry deal with that if he wants to. But it's just the way it's written. It's not that he was mistaken. So we'll be dismissed. Thanks for your attention. And we'll be meeting back next hour.